we brought in a production company to kind of help create a campaign video to get out to alums so they can, you know, learn more about the program and we can put some ask out there. During that 2 week period when the production came in, I was probably the happiest I had been. I was coming up with a lot of the questions, a lot of the themes. I was working with the student athletes and the coaches and the alums to kind of pull this thing together. And I was really excited. So I turned to the gentleman that we brought in. And I asked him, I was like, hey, look, man, is this what production is? And he was like, yeah, man, you're a hell of a producer. And literally, like, when he said that, the light bulb went off in my head. I'm like, wait a minute, this is something that I want to look into a little bit more. Because I had known about production and TV and film, but didn't fully know, like, the different sides of it and the different, you know, types of production. And so that's kind of when the light bulb went off in my head.
This is The Change Up. I'm Keith Hernandez. This week's guest is co-founder of Crossover Collective, Walt Brock. We talk about how he realized his calling was producing while at a university athletic department, creating a show with CeCe Sabathia and Edwin Jackson, and how athletes are building their brands into businesses. All right, excited about this week's guest. This week we have Walt Brock, co-founder of Crossover Collective. Walt Brock, Walt, welcome to the show, man. How you doing?
Doing well, Keith. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, man. So we met a few months ago and I was really impressed with what you had built. And then I was even more excited to find out that this was a leap of faith for you to start this company and a departure from what you were doing in the past. Tell us a little bit about what Crossover Collective is and what you've been up to over the last few months.
Sure. So Crossover Collective, we're a cultural brand and media house. We focus in on, you know, creating original content that really tells narratives and different sides of things that are taking place, you know, within the sports and entertainment realm and also culturally as well. We focus in on original content. We also provide production services. And then from a brand standpoint, we work directly with athletes to help them develop their brands. And then also with brands that are trying to get into the cultural space. And then we help them with branded content and also everything from brand development as well. So that's what we kind of focus in on. We started off heavy experiential before COVID hit. And just like everyone, we had to pivot. But when we first started, we worked with Nike and we did a 5K that ran through Crenshaw during Black History Month. We had over 700 plus runners in February of 2020. And we had planned on kind of rolling out some more and then also worked with Chase Bank. Kevin Hart has a series called Heart of It All, where he teaches financial literacy. And then also Steph Curry, Sweatworking. So we were actually in the Bay Area. They had an activation in Oakland. And then we went to the Warriors game the next day. And then literally 2 days later, everything shut down from a COVID standpoint. So we started off heavy experiential and we were able to kind of pivot into what we're doing now.
Oh, very cool. Side note, was that the last sporting event that you've been to or have you been to something since?
You know what? That's a great question. I think that may have been, well, you know what? We went to MLB All-Star Weekend in Denver. Okay. This past year. Yep. But it was probably one of the last ones that we attended before everything shut down.
Yeah, I just asked that question because I remember vividly for me, I went to a Brooklyn Nets versus Memphis Grizzlies game where the Grizzlies won by like 48. So it was like the worst taste. It was like the ugliest basketball. And then everything shut down and I still haven't been to a professional game since.
Yeah.
So how did you get those first projects going? I love, you know, blue chip brands, Chase and Nike, man, can't get better than that. How'd you navigate and find those brands to start this project off?
Yeah. So kind of back up a little bit. The first client that my business partner and I locked in, the Drew League, based in Los Angeles, a historic pro-am league that's been around since the 70s. And so that was the first league that we worked with that kind of really helped them from a brand development partnership standpoint. And we're still working with them to this day as well. And then one of the agencies that was working with the Drew League and actually helped their summertime activations, we actually partnered with them to see kind of what other projects they had from an experiential standpoint. One of them was the Nike event that took place. The project was a little on the smaller end for them to take on as a bigger agency. And so we were able to come in from a collective and partner on bringing over 700 runners to the Crenshaw area, really promote physical fitness and awareness. We partnered with a young man. His name's Ulrich Austin. He goes by Butta. And essentially, it's a group called Keep It Run 100. And Keep It Run 100 is focused in on promoting physical activity and community through movement and running in South Central Los Angeles. So we partnered with them on putting together a great event. And so once we did that one, we kind of proved ourselves from that perspective. The same agency came back and said, hey, look, you know, we're doing some work with both Steph Curry and Kevin Hart through Chase Bank. Do you all have some interest in, you know, kind of help position in rolling this out nationwide? And we're like, absolutely. So we went up to the Bay Area. And I remember we had two activations. One was at Castlemont High School and Oakland High. Very familiar with them growing up in the Bay Area. So, you know, work with them on that part. And then literally the next day, we went to the Warriors game and Steph was out that game. And then, you know, everything from there kind of shifted. So we were a little bummed about that because Chase also had kind of a global race activation. Mm-hmm. It was kind of like a corporate fitness challenge, but it was global. So we were having some conversations around that as well. And then things shifted.
Yeah. So now things have shifted to primarily video production, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And so talk a little bit about the way that you think about this. Are you creating videos for YouTube and Snapchat? Are you creating them for streaming platforms like Amazon? What's the philosophy that your company has in video creation?
Yeah, you know, right now content is king. Everyone needs content in some form or fashion. So whether it's us working with athletes who are trying to acquire different brand partnerships, but they have to authentically, you know, tell their stories and narratives. And so we found a sweet spot that between the 2 to 5 minute window mm-hmm. has been very useful and helpful for athletes that want to kind of put their brand, you know, narratives out there. So for example, we worked with Lewis Brinson, who was a outfielder for the Miami Marlins, and he wanted to get into fashion. So we're like, okay, what do you have out there that shows that you want to be a student, you know, of fashion? He's like, man, you know, I don't really have anything. I said, okay, cool. So we actually worked with him and also the vintage Tommy Hilfiger brand, and we were able to do some storytelling and narratives around Lewis's interest into fashion and then also the historic Hilfiger brand and everything that they've done and the influence that they've had on sports and in music as well. So we were able to pull together a really good short form narrative that Lewis was able to send out and pitch. And so now I believe he has a sock brand and some other brands that he's aligned with. And then also Major League Baseball picked that piece up for it and circulated that last spring as well. So that just gives you an example of kind of some of the content from a brand development standpoint. Right now, there's a lot of competition out there when it comes to, you know, brands, a lot of multiple sports. So athletes have to really be authentic and also intentional about the content that they create. That's one side of it. The other side is, you know, we create original content. So right now we have 5 series that are in development and 3 of them have picked up right now and we're developing with a platform. And so what we're doing is telling authentic stories and kind of giving different perspectives. So one show is called The Change Up.
I'm rooting for that show.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, featured CC Sabathia cool. and also Edwin Jackson. They both have very unique stories in terms of the impact that they've made in Major League Baseball. And now they're literally both faces of the Players Alliance and the MLB in helping continue to grow the game in diverse communities. And so we were like, well, look, you know, the Change Up is an opportunity to be a visual representation of the work that's being done in diverse communities. And while we were actually filming with them in Denver, Major League Baseball committed over $150 million over a 10-year period to help continue to grow the game in Black and brown communities. And so we literally are now developing the show, where it's focusing in on fashion, it's focusing in on music, and it's showing the other side of baseball, because baseball has influenced a lot of our society, right? It's truly America's game, but sometimes, you know, from a cultural standpoint, it doesn't get the right recognition. We're working on that series. We're also doing another show that's called Tailgate Flavor, featuring Spice Adams. So Spice, you know, he played in the league and has done a really good job of transitioning into a comedian and also kind of his own personality. So essentially we're going to different campuses and having conversations around kind of the Black American experience, but through the lens of football and food.
Cool.
And so Tailgate Flavor, we shot 2 episodes already this past year and we plan on doing a full rollout this upcoming year as well. So those are 2 examples of kind of, hey, you know, we're taking different angles and perspectives around the content that we're shooting.
Very cool. And I'm very familiar with Spice Adams because he did some work with us at House of Highlights when I was at Bleacher Report.
Here we go.
I think his character, just Spice Adams, but he plays basketball and bricks it 95% of the time.
Oh, Kareem. I think it's Kareem Bigham.
Yeah, that's right. That's who it is. Yeah. It's a great character and got a lot of shares and comments. And then, yeah, Edwin Jackson was probably on one of my fantasy baseball team like for 14 years in a row. Because I think he has the distinction of playing on the most Major League Baseball teams. I think it's something like 11 or 12.
You're correct. Yeah. It's actually 14. 14 in total.
Yeah.
14 in total. Yeah. So Edwin's story is amazing, man.
He grew up in Germany, isn't that right? Or he was born in Germany?
No, you're on it. So he was born in Germany and grew up in Columbus, Georgia. So not too far outside of Atlanta. But got to start with the Dodgers, I think, right out of high school. He was 18, 19. He was actually drafted as an outfielder. But every time he would throw, kind of, you know, do his relay throws to home plate, they're like, wait a minute, this guy has an arm. So they, you know, converted him over to a pitcher.
Had a little cut, a little zip.
Yeah. Converted him to a pitcher. And I mean, he's thrown a no-hitter. When he was with the Diamondbacks, he won a World Series with the Cardinals. He was an all-star with the Detroit Tigers, right? So his story is phenomenal of the impact that he's made. So CC and Edwin are both amazing guys. And I think telling the story through their lens, they have a unique position. They really connect the younger generation with the older generation as well.
Absolutely.
There's a lot of good storytellers there.
Yeah, and CC Sabathia, if you haven't seen him since he retired, it's a complete transition, what he's done with his body and his mind and his health. I don't know how much weight he's lost, but it's more about the strength that he's gained. Can you talk a little bit about that and kind of the new mindset of CC since his retirement?
Absolutely, man. CC is one of the most down-to-earth guys. And it's funny because he's from Vallejo, California.
Yeah, West Coast guy, yeah.
Yeah, West Coast guy. That's actually where I'm at today. My mom and sister live in Vallejo. And so very familiar with this story, you know, growing up. But his transition post-career is very impressive. One, from what he's been doing, you know, physically, but more from a mental standpoint, man. Yeah. You know, there was a couple of vices that he was battling and kind of going through and he's overcome. But also he's using his platform to inspire change. Let people know, like, hey, look, man, we all go through different things. We all have challenges in life, but if you're intentional about, you know, working through them, we can do so. And so he's been a great example of that. But then also just how he's been able to get into the content space. His documentary that was on HBO, done really, really well. Phenomenal documentary. And he's literally like one of the faces of Major League Baseball. This past summer, when the commissioner, you know, said, hey, look, you know, we're committing $150 million. To help grow the game, CC was sitting right next to the commissioner. So it just shows kind of how he's been able to elevate, not only as a player, but now post his career, been very impressive.
Yeah, and what I loved about that documentary too is it shed light on the relationship with his wife and how strong she is and how much of a push she is to kind of help him be better and continue through this journey that is, you know, the struggle that is life. And she's been there. So it was amazing seeing her story as well.
Absolutely. No, Amber Sabathia, she is a rock star.
Yeah,
she's a rock star. Like literally, she is a big reason why we're at where we're at right now with our series, because she gets it. She understands it. And she's been a champion behind closed doors to help us get a lot of access and to help us move it through. So, no, she's amazing. And now, you know, she's able to, you know, really use her baseball knowledge and love for the game to be one of the premier agents. She's over at CAA.
Yeah.
She's doing some amazing things there. So, no, it's been literally a blessing to be able to work with both Amber and CeCe and Edwin as well.
Yeah. So, what is it about baseball that I think, you know, I'm a huge baseball fan and I grew up, my name kind of forced me to play baseball and kind of got me into it at an early age, but it's a sport that I've always loved. But, you know, my nephew never even played. He only played football, and more younger kids, especially in urban areas, opt out of the sport pretty early or never even play the sport. So what is it about? Is it the slowness of it or is it just the opportunity? What have you, in talking with Edwin and CeCe, kind of learned about what's happening with baseball?
Yeah, you know, I think it is a slower game. So I think that's something that baseball has been kind of battling with, you know, since the beginning, right? Yeah. Kind of figuring out ways to keep the game flow, moving and entertaining. I honestly feel like it's been more from a representation standpoint, where a lot of times you'll have your football and basketball players that are, you know, celebrated a little bit more visually, you know, in neighborhoods and also on TV as well. I think when you look at a lot of the bigger endorsement deals, you think a lot of the kind of crossover opportunities for a lot of athletes. You've seen it more for, you know, predominantly football and basketball athletes. And so I think that, and then also when you look at it from a standpoint of seeing the path to get there, right? So if you play football or basketball, you know pretty quickly that you'll maybe have a shot to the NBA or NFL, and you may play, you know, a full 4 years in college or not, and then you'll get there. Whereas from a baseball standpoint, it is a longer road, right?
Yeah, that's a great point.
Yeah, you get to the minors, and sometimes, you know, depending upon which minor league system you're in, you're developed the right way, you get opportunities, sometimes you don't. And sometimes people's careers kind of end from that perspective. So I think the path to get to the MLB is something that has been a challenge as well. And I think finally the last thing is that, so like, CeCe is a great example of, CeCe was that one baseball player that you would see that was signed to Roc Nation, he would hang with Jay-Z, he would move around with a lot of athletes and also rappers and other folks kind of seamlessly. And I think that's why people really gravitate towards him, because like, wow, he was able to kind of really do it in a very authentic way. It's funny. I was watching the Colin Kaepernick series on Netflix, and he literally said like, hey, look, I could have been a major league baseball pitcher.
Yeah.
He said, but honestly, I didn't feel accepted playing baseball. Just kind of culturally, I didn't feel accepted. That's why I leaned more towards football. And so I think that is something, that's the other piece of it, is that, you know, sometimes, you know, when you play, you may be one of a few. So I think that community hasn't always been there. So I think that's something else that they're trying to focus in on as well.
Yeah, some great points there, right? Like, so you look at Kyler Murray, who got drafted by the Oakland A's and could have gone that path, but he chose the Arizona Cardinals. And now he's starting quarterback for a maybe top 10 team, you know, definitely a playoff bound team. So like, you're totally right there. And then I think of a player like Tim Anderson on the Chicago White Sox, who is living how he wants to live and is very good. But sometimes baseball makes it hard for the players to be themselves. And he's talked about that multiple times now. he's a Major League Baseball All-Star, but he's also feels a little bit that he has to kind of tone himself down, even though his regular self isn't that much, right? Like, yeah. So that's another hard part with baseball.
Absolutely. I think that piece where, I think it was LeBron or someone where it was like kind of a shut up and dribble kind of mentality was there. I know for years there have been a lot of baseball players, not just baseball players of color, right? Just kind of across the board where it's like, hey, look, in order for the game to grow, let us kind of have a little bit more personality, you know, and let that show, because again, this is entertainment at the end of the day, right? Yep. It's a game and you're trying to attract more people to it. So I think that's definitely a great point. But the last point too, I'll make Keith on it is just accessibility to the game, right? So I think the game has now become more expensive.
Absolutely.
Where it used to be, you know, when I was younger, you know, kind of growing up in the Bay Area, we would play baseball in the parks, we would kind of run around. We had the RBI program as well. So a lot of those community-based programs have kind of gone away, and it's more of that kind of pay-to-play model now where you have to have a good amount of money to, you know, be a part of a travel team. There's American Legion. There's so many different things, and everything literally costs. And so I think that's kind of a shift has also, you know, kind of hindered the game. And that's where the Players Alliance has kind of really jumped in, and that's where they have their national tour, and they're trying to do different things to address that and to give away equipment and different things of that nature. But the accessibility and cost have definitely played a role as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I root for the sport. I want it to be the number one sport again in the United States. It sounds like you played baseball a little bit as a kid, but you definitely played football, right? You played it in college.
I did. Yeah. So definitely I played baseball growing up, and I have fond memories too of my mom and sister, my family, uncles taking me to Candlestick Park when the Giants were playing there. And so I have fond memories. And that was during the era too, when Barry Bonds was, oh my goodness.
You saw the best. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I literally saw that end of it. And then also just kind of, you know, seeing the impact and the legacy of, you know, Willie Mays and Willie McCovey. And you can really visually see that in San Francisco and in the Bay. And also you go across the bridge, you go to Oakland, Reggie Jackson, Dave Stewart, Ricky Henderson, right? So like that's the era that I grew up in. So baseball, although it wasn't one of those sports that was still on the high end, you know, from football perspective, like it was a big part of my household. Like, it's funny, I tell people all the time, my grandmother, she passed a few years back, but she literally religiously would listen to the Giants baseball game on the radio and watch it locally. So like I'll come in and check in on her, or even when I'm, you know, living in different places and I'm calling in, I'm like, hey, how are the Giants doing? Right. So like for me, it's like an emotional connection to baseball as well.
I love that so much. Yeah. Because you can't slow down the game that way, right? Like listening to it on the radio, you can't just kind of have it in the background and do some other things and pick up some phone calls and do that.
Yeah.
So I want to talk a little bit more about crossover. And I love that you've jumped into this video production stuff. Do you have a video production background? Is this where you started your career?
Absolutely not.
Okay. Good answer. No. Let's dig in.
Yeah. So, you know, I was a football student athlete in college. Played both at St. Mary's College of California and Sacramento State. And St. Mary's discontinued the program. I was able to finish up and get my undergrad from there, and then went to Sacramento State to play my last 2 years of football, and really had a great experience. But I dove right into athletic administration. I had an internship at the NCAA office in Indy. Was very fortunate to be able to be a part of a cohort of, I think it was maybe 16 people at that time. So I had a chance to work on everything from the legislation side and the rules to volunteering and working for the Final Four events and getting a lot of exposure. I worked for Conference USA down in Dallas, doing a lot of championships and operations. Moved back to the Bay Area and worked for the Raiders in the business development and partnerships, you know, area on that side. And then worked for UC Berkeley and Cal for 5 years in the development area. So I was literally, you know, we're on the front lines, you know, working with alums, working with coaches, student athletes, and raising money for different capital campaigns.
Very cool.
And so while I'm doing all of this, one of the things is, you know, when you're working with alums or from a fundraising standpoint, you always are trying to find the stories or the narratives that will connect, right? And also will demonstrate, you know, what the impact is. And so I think going through that process for me was something that really jumped out. And so the last stop that I had was at Columbia University in New York. It was a great opportunity. I was overseeing the development and fundraising area for athletics. While I was there, had a mental health institute and kind of campaign that we were creating for the student athletes. And we brought in a production company to kind of help create a campaign video to get out to alums so they can, you know, learn more about the program and we can put some asks out there. During that 2 week period when the production came in, I was probably the happiest I had been. I was coming up with a lot of the questions, a lot of the themes. I was working with the student athletes and the coaches and the alums to kind of pull this thing together. And I was really excited. So I turned to the gentleman that we brought in. And I asked him, I was like, hey, look, man, is this what production is? And he was like, yeah, man, you're a hell of a producer.
Cool.
And literally, like, when he said that, the light bulb went off in my head. I'm like, wait a minute, this is something that I want to look into a little bit more, because I had known about production and TV and film, but didn't fully know, like, the different sides of it and the different, you know, types of production. And so that's kind of when the light bulb went off in my head. And I'm engaged at the time, you know, getting ready to get married that December. And I walked away from Columbia. I walked away from a full-time job. It was paying me well. I thought I wanted to become an athletic director. And I was kind of, I was on that path.
You were on that track, yeah.
Yeah, as you know, Keith, because it's all about fundraising and it's all about, you know, being able to do that. I've been in some really good places and had some good positions, but something was tugging at my heart saying, oh, no, there's something more there. So literally walked away. And I was fortunate enough to get in touch with a gentleman by the name of Keith Klinscales. And Keith founded Vibe Magazine with Quincy Jones back in the day and also was one of the lead executives for ESPN's 30 for 30 well. And so he had created a company called the Shadow League. And the Shadow League was based in the Black Enterprise office in New York City right off of Madison Avenue. So I had a chance to literally spend a good amount of time learning under Keith, working with the creatives. We created some podcasts. We produced some original series and things of that nature. And so that's where I was like, wait a minute, this is really what I want to do. And so I'm very, very, very fortunate for Keith. So basically, I had a glorified internship, to be honest.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, like, because this is a far departure. Smart guy, graduate, you got your degree, and you're on this path. But now you've shifted it completely. How do you position that to Keith and say, hey, I want to come in and I want to help? You said it, glorified internship. What does that mean?
Yeah, so I think that the way that I sold it to Keith was like, hey, look, Keith, you know, I have a lot of relationships and background in, you know, the traditional sports side. So there was a couple of like athletic director series that they wanted to launch. I said, well, hey, look, I have great access to that side and I lived it. So I can kind of help, you know, those narratives. Also, when it came to developing some of the podcasts and getting them on different platforms, while I was at Cal and also the Raiders, we worked on a partnership with Pandora. So one of my good friends that was at Pandora had left and she had moved over to Spotify. And she was literally working out of the Spotify office in New York. And so I was like, hey, look, I can kind of help maybe leverage and better position some of the podcasts that we want to create. So I just literally leveraged the relationships that I had and also the knowledge that I had to say, hey, look, you know, it's one thing to have the traditional video production side of it. But I think what's been missing sometimes is also having the real world sports experience as well. Absolutely. And kind of being able to marry that. That's how I was able to leverage.
That's amazing. I want to go back a little bit to what you were saying about noticing that you were smiling and noticing that you had this newfound energy, right? A lot of people don't take that step and stop themselves and recognize and realize that. They might feel dope those days and feel great, but then go right back to the work. What allowed you in terms of just kind of recognizing that? Like, what was it about that moment that made you so happy and made you so excited and said, you know what, this should be my future?
You know, Keith, I think I kind of go back to growing up. You know, my mom was really big into just taking risks and opportunities. You know, when I was younger, we moved from California to Alabama while she pursued a degree in theology. And all of our family was in California. You know, she had already received her degree in social work and some other things. But she's like, no, I need this extra piece in order for me to get to where I need to be. And so although the circumstances weren't the best, you know, financially, she knew what kind of drove and moved her. And so I think just by vicariously, you know, living through that and seeing her side of it, I think that helped motivate me. So I think for me, like I had always operated, you know, having that gut feeling of like, okay, you know, I love working in sports, but I had been on the campus side of it. And I had also been on the conference side as well and professional side. And so I've been on all levels. And I was like, look, you know, as I want to kind of balance having a family and doing different things, sometimes when you're working on the team side or the college side, like your time is theirs all the time, which again, there's nothing wrong with that if that's what you love to do. But I just kind of always envisioned it kind of having a little bit more balance and kind of, you know, operating and doing things kind of from a personal standpoint. So when the light bulb went off and I was happy during that 2 week period, I literally, when I started going back to doing my normal kind of day-to-day responsibilities, my mind just kept on going back to the production, kept on going back to the production. So I kept on looking at different series, different things, and I just couldn't let it go. So I had a conversation with my wife then at the time, fiance. And I took that leap. And again, like we're in New York City, we're literally getting ready to get married.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't the smartest decision. It wasn't at all. Like I had mapped it out a little bit financially. I thought I had enough to get us, you know, but when I looked again, I was like, but I was already gone. And I think at that time too, we were living in New York, living in Harlem. So when you're walking the streets of Harlem, you You hear the music, you see the creativity and the art, and also it's a place where you have to be resilient. You have to get up in the morning when it's, you know, 10 degrees, you have to keep pushing. And so I think all of those elements of being in New York during that period of time was definitely destined, and it was a blessing for me to kind of make that transition, or be the stage to make the transition.
That's great. I want to learn a little bit about what your wife said, but before, I want to kind of set it up. And hopefully I'm not blowing your spot with this one, but at that same conference that we met at, you were hosting a panel, and you're calling the guest up onto the stage. And you were reading the paper, and then you look up, and it's your wife that you introduced, and you gave the most genuine, oh, hey, baby, that I've ever seen anybody give to the significant other. And I could just tell that there's love between you and support between you. So I'm asking this question because I don't think there was going to be strife, but what was that conversation like with your wife and saying, hey, I'm off this track, I'm on this track, and I hope you come with me?
Yeah. So the conversation, She was at first, I think the response was like, oh, hey, look, you know, we're getting married in December. So like, what is the plan?
We locked that in.
Yeah. So I think once we got over kind of that initial piece and I kind of made the jump in the lead, she supported me, man. And she held me down. And to be honest, she had worked with the gentleman Keith that I mentioned at Revolt TV when she was working there and doing some work with Sean Combs. And so as I was going through my process, I was already planning on connecting with them. But as I had made it known that, hey, look, I want to make this jump, she set up the first dinner with Keith and we conversated. And ever since then, like she's like a lot of the series that we're working on right now, you know, we brainstorm. It's funny, when we lived in Inglewood in California, we called my little small one bedroom apartment, we called it the bunker. Essentially, like I would have like newsprint kind of put up all across the walls, and we would map out different series, and a lot of the things that we're doing today are because of her and her, you know, believing in me. So no, man, I would not be here today if it wasn't for her support, and also her, you know, kind of holding me down during those periods of times where I didn't know when the next check was coming, or the next check came and then it was gone right when it came in. And so I think that's something that needs to be told about the entrepreneurial journey. I know it looks different for everyone. But I know for me, having that support at home and having someone that kind of sees the vision, they may not see the vision all the way with you, but they know that you're progressing towards that, and they help hold you down during the process is important.
Well, that's love and that support. And I could see it. You know, I only met you both briefly, but I could see that mutual level of respect and support that was there. I'd love to talk a little bit about the financials. You're bootstrapped, correct?
Yeah.
Because I think there's a big difference when people think about companies and how they start. Because I've talked to some people who've raised $20 or $30 million. And for them, it's, okay, let's go. I'm shooting for the moon. Versus I myself am bootstrapped. And it's more of a, I want to grow this methodical. Can you talk a little bit about the financials that went into starting the company bootstrap, and like how you think about, you know, is it month to month, quarter by quarter, year by year, the growth of your company?
Yeah, Keith. So literally, my business partner, Steph Rollins, and I, man, when we started our company, it was us putting our own money in. Basically, the way that we were able to build it up was by, you know, when the projects came in. So Essentially, the Drew League was the first group that we brought in. And then fast forward to the Nike 5K. And then things are paused from that standpoint. And so that's when we pivoted into the different models. So literally, we're in the middle of COVID. You know, we're focusing in on production, but no one wants to shoot in person. Because, you know, everyone's kind of scared of, you know, what's taking place, and letting the science hopefully kind of guide everything from that standpoint. So what we had to do was we got creative and we connected with Quality Control Music Group, which they have now expanded into sports representation. So they had Alvin Kamara, they had DeAndre Swift, plus for the Lions, and then also Deebo Samuel. So we were able to work with them on literally just taking pre-existing content that they already had, and kind of putting our own twist to it. And so we did a piece for Alvin Kamara that was more focused on branding off the field. He had a couple brand deals that he was working on. DeAndre Swift was a young rookie at the time, coming out of Georgia. And he was got drafted by the Detroit Lions. So we needed to do like a welcome to the NFL, welcome to the league moment. And then for Deebo Samuel, Deebo switched his marketing representation over to Quality Control. So we did a piece that was like welcome to Quality Control for him. So those were the first three kind of video content pieces that we did, and we repurposed the content and we pulled together these great pieces that they were able to use. So that's kind of how we jumped into the video side. And then from there, our first big project, Baron Davis. Baron Davis took a huge risk on us and a chance, but he had his platform called Slick. It's sports, lifestyle, and culture. And essentially, we were able to come in and create 2 to 3 pilot episodes, you know, for him on that one, the summer of, that was what, spring, summer of 2020. So that's kind of how we really jumped in into it all the way. Those are some of our bigger first big projects. So to answer your question from a financial standpoint, we literally, man, were just kind of, you know, project will come in, we'll take care of the bills that we had and take care of the bills of the company, then reinvest and leverage the projects that we had until it continued to grow some more. So now we're in a spot where, you know, we are looking into, you know, having more investments. And now we have a track record content, and also we have series that are moving and all that. We've been very mindful, too, of just making sure that whoever we bring in from a support standpoint, that we are mindful of, that it aligns with, you know, our vision and kind of how we're operating and moving. But you're right, man. It's tough to get it off the ground that way. But I feel like it's so much sweeter when it does work out that way, because we're now in a position where we can build our company. And hopefully over the next 3-4 years, we'll be in a position to, if we wanted to, you know, sell it or do something of that nature, we will have hopefully the autonomy to do that.
Yeah. I don't know if my advice is good for everybody, but like some people who ask if they should raise $10 or $20 million, I say, go for it. But now you're an employee of your vision, right? Like you have a board of directors, you have the investors. Whereas if you could bootstrap it, you're able to say yes or no to the things that you want. And I think that's pretty powerful, right? Especially somebody, you know, I grew up with almost zero money in the family, and to be able to have that autonomy in what I'm going to have to do versus taking whatever job is given to me, like that matters.
No, it does, Keith. And I would also attribute it to just being from the Bay Area. In the Bay, you've heard the stories of, you know, E-40 and, you know, Too Short and Master P. Like, there's a lot of examples of people who are like, look, you know, going the independent route and kind of out of the trunk model, right? Where it's like, hey, I believe in my product. I believe in what I have. There may not be major distribution yet, but I'm going to go ahead and push it myself and just kind of create my own buzz. And I think that's what we've been able to do. My business partner, he's from Queens. So he kind of operates the same way in terms of kind of his mentality. And I think it's like, hey, because sometimes what happens is people wait for all of the resources to be there before they start the action. And if we would have waited for all the resources to be there, nothing would have came out yet. Like, we would have still been waiting. And so my advice is always like, hey, look, you know, make sure that you have the resources that you need to get going. But I feel like always the action always attracts everything else that you need. And so that's kind of how we approached it. And again, we, you know, we had some favor and some blessings along the way, too, to kind of get us to where we're at right now.
Yeah, I think that's a big one too, because so many people talk about either the solopreneur or the, you know, two-person partnership and how they did it all themselves. It sounds like you have a real recognition that there's a lot of people that are helping out along the way, and the support is crucial to the next stage of your growth.
Oh, absolutely, Keith. I mean, and the beautiful thing about, you know, Steph and I's relationship is like, you know, he would have a contact who can help us open the door, and then we'll have a concept to go with, or vice versa. We're able to kind of play off each other, but there's so many people from his side and my side that have been kind of behind the scenes, who've made intros for us, who've helped us get in the door, because they see kind of, you know, they see where we're going. But yeah, if anyone says, hey, you know, I've done it by myself, it's not true. And I feel
it's
like
a red flag.
Yeah, it's definitely a red flag. And I think that partnerships, the right partnerships, are always better, because it just helps you move, accelerate things, you know, faster. Like, if Steph would have, you know, jumped out there on his own, or if I would have done it on my own, I think we would have had some movement, but nowhere near where we're at today, kind of bringing our collective relationships and passions together.
How did you two find each other?
On LinkedIn. We connected on LinkedIn, man. Okay. It's a crazy story. So when I was working at the Shadow League, we were doing a branded series on athletic directors, and we were looking for an automotive partner. And so I went on LinkedIn, and at the time, Steph was overseeing the national multicultural BMW account. Okay. So I reached out to him on LinkedIn. We had a chance to have a conversation. It didn't work out for us to kind of work on that project together, but when my wife and I moved back to LA, Steph and I had a chance to sit down, and we connected and kind of have the same visions, and we kind of moved from there. So the first intro was me reaching out on LinkedIn. And you know how that goes sometimes, Keith, right? You reach out to someone on LinkedIn, they may respond or they may not. And so, it worked out.
Well, that's a good endorsement for following up with people on LinkedIn. You might turn it into a real business.
Absolutely.
And so how do you divvy up the work? How have you guys decided who does what and how things get accomplished on a day-to-day?
Yeah, so initially it was, you know, hey, all hands on deck. Let's make sure that we get everything done. And so now what we do is we kind of lean into each other's strengths. Steph, you know, he comes from a heavy agency background, worked with Cashmere, worked for Optimus. He's done a lot of, you know, sneaker campaigns. He really has a good, great visual eye and aesthetic as well for design. So everything when it comes to, you know, our creative direction, when it comes to like our brand development work that we do, and a lot of like set design kind of looks, feels, stuff, you know, really leads that side of it. From a production side of it, that's where I lead from storytelling, narrative. A lot of our production, I'll take the lead on kind of, you know, getting things moving from that perspective. And then from a sports standpoint as well, in terms of, you know, just my sports background that I have, tying in, you know, different athletes or executives and things of that nature. So that's kind of how we've broken up our responsibilities so far.
Very cool. What advice would you give somebody who thinks they want to get into production, but they're not necessarily sure? Should they go to a big company like ESPN and get that tutelage that you also got, or should they just go out there with a camera and start shooting?
I would say get out there and start shooting. If you have an opportunity to, you know, work for someone who's been at an ESPN or one of those platforms, I'd say yes, that's helpful. But I think the smaller production side allows you to grow faster. And the reason why I said that is because you have to wear all types of hats. Like, we've literally have been producers, directors, set designers. We've learned the editing process. So you have to really kind of fully immerse yourself. Whereas if you jump in with a bigger company or production, sometimes you'll be kind of pigeonholed into whatever position that may be at the time. And you may get some opportunities to move around. But I would say that, and also volunteer and serve as production assistants as much as you can. Because a lot of times just being around and seeing what's taking place, you can absorb. And that's kind of, you know, that's how it was for me initially. I was just sitting in on a couple different sets. I would have conversations with the videographers, the photographers, the editors, kind of learning more about the process. And that helped me kind of learn, like, okay, hey, how can we take the actual creative side of it and turn it into a business as well? So, yeah, so I would say, yeah, jump in there, roll your sleeves up, try it. And then for people who are trying to, who may not have a production background,
yeah,
what I learned was that, you know, producing looks different for everyone, right? And we all are producers. All of us are producers just in life in general, right? If you have a, you know, a business, you have a family, whatever it may be, like, you being able to visually say, hey, look, I need X, Y, and Z to be done, and this is how we're going to do it, and you actually execute it, you're a producer. And so I think that's the mentality that you have to have. Like, okay, I've already produced and I've done different things. Now this just looks differently for a TV series or a film series, whatever it may be. But really leveraging on those transferable skills that you have that will help you be successful in this lane as well.
I love that. So what's been the hardest thing over the last couple of years producing that you're surprised about?
You know what? I would say the hardest thing is, I think, two things. One is developing and building the right crew. And when I say that, it's like, you know, building the relationships with the right videographers, the right editors, making sure that the right personalities and skill sets really mesh well. I think that's been a learning experience for us. And again, it's going to be trial and error. Each project is different.
Yeah.
And knowing too that each videographer and editor or producer, sometimes they have their niche, right? Which may work better for them or not. So I think working through that process. I would say the second thing is also when you go from, okay, hey, I can create content now and we create good content, but now I need a place for it to live somewhere, right? Where's it going to live?
Right.
So I think that transition, it can be a little murky if you don't have an agent, if you don't have good relationships, you know, within the TV or film world, it could be kind of a lost place because you're like, where do I go? How do I meet these people? And how do I separate myself from, you know, the thousands of other people who are trying to pitch their work as well? So I think those two elements, one, finding the right, you know, building out your crew and your team. And then also, you know, you're going from, hey, okay, now we can create great content. How do we go from there to getting our content so the world can see it?
Oh, that's great. And how complex are those relationships, right? Like talking to the big streaming platforms and the services. I listened to a podcast a couple of days ago, actually. It said there's something like 30 or 40,000 shows that are in pre-production right now. It's just wild how much actual good original content is out there. How do you break through that?
Yeah, you know what, Keith? That it's an ongoing thing.
It's a billion-dollar question.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. I would say it goes back to relationships in terms of, you know, being able to, you know, connect with people at the networks and showing the value. One thing that we learned quickly too is because, you know, everyone is pitching and everyone is trying to get on, the more work that you do up front, the easier it is in order for it to get done. Because at the end of the day, if I'm an executive at a platform, I already have my day-to-day responsibilities, plus everyone's pitching me daily. So if there's a series that comes across my desk where I have to roll my sleeves up and kind of really jump in to help develop it, it may be one of the best ideas. Maybe one of the best ideas in the world, but it's going to take me more time to actually get it where it needs to be. Whereas if from your end, if you're able to go ahead and shoot a proof of concept, you're able to kind of package it and have a vision for what the episodes are, the breakdown. Now you come to the table showing one, you're invested in the work because you've done the legwork. And then two, you show the executive like, okay, well, look, I know that if I partner with this production company, one, they're going to be professional, they're going to come together, but they're also going to be able to really lead the work. And I think those are the two things I would say that have really been able to kind of help us separate ourselves as we kind of get in there is those two or three things.
That's great advice, man. That's specific and detailed great advice that I think a lot of people should follow there. So as I wrap up the conversations with folks, I usually ask them not to make a prediction on what the next year is going to look like, because, you know, predictions always go wrong. But I like to ask, if we met up this time next year, what do you hope to be most proud of? What do you hope to have accomplished and we could talk about and say, yeah, I did that?
Yeah, you know what, Keith? I would say that we follow up this time, 2023, man. Yeah, I know, right? Time is flying already. It's already the middle, almost the middle of January. But you know, the shows that we have in development, that they are on, you know, on platforms, and they're making an impact. Like all the shows that we're doing right now, too. Yes, you know, yes, we're in it, right, for monetary reasons. Yeah, absolutely, right. Like we want to make money. That's the goal. But at the end of the day, too, the series that we have, we want to start conversations. We want people to connect themselves with them. We want to create community around them. We want to create conversations around them, too. So if our shows are buzzing from a standpoint of people are excited about them, they're making change, we're creating conversation, that I'll be more happy about that compared to, you know, the dollar amount that we get from them. It's more about the cultural impact that we can make from now until then.
Oh, I love that, man. So how can people get in touch with you? How can they learn a little bit more about Crossover Collective, but more importantly, how can they start spending money with you?
Absolutely. So we're on LinkedIn. You can find our Crossover Collective page on LinkedIn. We're also on Instagram as well. And that's Crossover, that's CROSSOVR_Collective, CollectiVe. And then our website is crossover.co, so CROSSOVR.co. And then finally, my personal Instagram and also on IG is WJ Brock. So WJBROCK. That's where you can find us. But yeah, no, we're looking forward to working with more brands and creating original content. The other thing too is what we're starting to move into as well is that there are a lot of creatives and people who have creative stories and ideas as well. Sometimes they just need the right production company to help bring them to life. And I think that's the next phase of what we're moving into, because now we have a great team of creators that now can also, we can help, you know, build out other people's stories and other things of that nature. So I think that's kind of the next way. So if you're looking to tell authentic stories and work with a group that can kind of bring that stuff to life, feel free to reach out to us.
Okay, cool. So that would be somebody that might just have a concept but doesn't have the execution arm or doesn't have the production chops?
Absolutely, yeah. Okay, so we come across it all the time where there's great ideas that are out there, but someone's like, hey, look, I don't even know where to start. And so that's where it's like, hey, look, we can kind of come together. We can help you, you know, take your concept and your idea from an ideation to actual execution, whether it's us, you know, coming together and creating a proof of concept for you, or actually producing a full series as well, whatever that may look like. So yeah, we can assist with that.
That's amazing. All right, cool. One last question, actually. You know, you were able to recognize that this was something that you were passionate about and excited about. What advice would you give to somebody who's sitting there in a career that they don't necessarily love, but they're not sure to kind of take that leap? What would you recommend to them?
Yeah, so my recommendation is kind of twofold. One, to really, you know, spend some time in a quiet space to kind of really focus in on what your purpose is and what your calling is. I think sometimes we get so caught up in the day-to-day, depending on whether it's your full-time job, family, whatever it may be, like there's always things that are pulling at us. And so sometimes we may hear things, but it's tough for us to kind of act on them until we get some clarity. So I would say, one, just kind of sit back, take a notepad, or like I really love like the newsprint. You can take like the erasable markers and kind of write things out of kind of what your ideas are, and then literally write down also like what's the path to get there. So I think sometimes, right. I think there's all, I mean, people love entrepreneurship, and I think sometimes it can be a sexy word, like, oh yeah, I'm an entrepreneur, but there's right. going to be some dark days for sure. There's going to be some dark days, and there's going to be moments where you're like, wait a minute, like, am I really going the right path? And I think you having the clarity of saying, hey, look, this is how this can tangibly get there, and having a roadmap, it's always going to be helpful. Of course, there's going to be detours on the journey, but at least you have kind of a guide of getting you there. And then the second thing I would say too is knowing when to take the leap. Again, in my example, I don't know if on paper it wasn't the right time. Honestly, it wasn't the right time. But at the same time, I would say the action is, again, the best thing to take. So even when I mean action, doesn't mean you have maybe make the leap all the way. Even if you have a full-time job right now and you can map out, like, hey, look, this is where I want to go. Here's how much I need to save. Here's how much I need funding wise in order for me to, you know, to launch this. But making sure that you're actively working towards your plan so that when it is time, it's not going to be seamless, but it's going to be easier, the transition for you.
Amazing, man. Thank you so much for your time today. Thank you so much for your insight and the specificity of that insight as well. I know that's going to help a lot of people. Ladies and gentlemen, Walt Brock, co-founder of Crossover Collective. Thank you.
Thank you, Keith. Appreciate it, man.
Thank you for listening to The Change Up, produced by Elena Weedland, with original music by Rodney Hazard. If you liked what you heard, we'd appreciate your support by liking, sharing, leaving a comment, and subscribing wherever you listen. Thanks once again. Until next time.